You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today is Ed Song, an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. Ed, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing very well. And then most importantly, it is not just Coyle and I on the call today. We are joined by two very distinguished guests.
Celebrities in the Christian humanist world, even. On one end, we have Victoria Reynolds Farmer. Victoria, can you go ahead and introduce yourself? Because once again, I have forgotten to ask for details from a guest.
No problem, Coyle. Thanks for having me. As Coyle said, I am Victoria Reynolds Farmer, and I am of the Christian Feminist podcast. I don't know that I get to be a Christian humanist celebrity, but I'll take the kindness anyway. I am Senior Manager of Audience Development at Public Radio International in Minneapolis during the daytime, and I like to do Christian Humanist Radio Network-related things for fun, mostly for fun.
I think that's a great way to summarize what we do on the podcast, right? It is mostly fun. I might steal that. Also joining us on the podcast is Alexis Neal, coming to you live from Bolivar, Missouri. Alexis is a adjunct professor of law or some such at Southwest Baptist University, an alderman for the city of Bolivar, and the designated fitted sheet folder in the Neal household. Alexis, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
And, folding the fitted sheets is the bane of my existence.
It is. I am convinced it's witchcraft, and I suspect some sort of supernatural deal has been made because it does not happen in nature.
I'm very particular, actually, about the sheets in our bed. I make the beds. I'm very particular about having a tight fitted sheets and then perfect hospital corners in the what do you call the other sheet? Just the sheet? Is it just the sheet?
The top sheet.
Flat sheet.
Top? Oh, really? Is that what it's called?
I've heard
top,
both.
A top sheet or a flat sheet, yeah.
Okay. Very particular about that.
So we've done an episode on masculinity, which I will encourage the listeners to go and listen to. And the Christian feminists have done a couple of episodes on complementarianism and egalitarianism, which is not the main topic of what we're doing here, although, of course, it will have to come under discussion from time to time. But we wanted to dig a little bit more into the other side of the discussion, specifically dealing with the question, what is femininity? So again, we're wanting to ask the question: what is a woman? What does it mean to be feminine? And in sort of the whole spectrum that we ask that question in the masculinity episode. So as with the masculinity episode, I'm assuming that all of us are sort of in agreement that, you know, a woman is somehow not a man, and that a woman is somehow not a child, and that there's more to being a woman than just the cultural definition, even if we don't necessarily know what that is, and even if it's hard to pin down, and even if there is there is some kind of real state to being a woman. Again, all things that we talked about with masculinity, and maybe that will even come under consideration as we get into some of these definitions. Ed, can you start us off with the definition of femininity from the Council of Biblical Manhood and Womanhood? We use their definition of masculinity, and I want us to go back to them for femininity as well.
Yeah, we referenced the Council on Biblical Manhood and Womanhood a lot in our last episode, since in many ways they are probably the foremost defenders of, more or less traditional views of masculinity and femininity. And so one thing that they say is that at the heart of mature femininity is a freeing disposition to affirm, receive, and nurture strength and leadership from worthy men in ways appropriate to a woman's differing relationships. So at the heart of that is this idea of nurturing. Specifically, it says strength and leadership from worthy men, interestingly, in ways appropriate to a woman's differing relationships.
Yeah, as with the masculinity episode, I think there are some strengths to that and some problems with that. I am curious, though, Ed, what did you think about that?
Yeah, so I spent a little bit more time working through some of this CBMW stuff. And, that particular definition is a little bit more pointed than I would say the picture that I got out of some of their other more general writings on the issue. And I should say, in our episode on masculinity, as well as in just in other conversations that we've had about issues of gender, I've always painted myself as an egalitarian. But I have always understood that a little bit more narrowly to refer to a view about men and women, well, leadership in the church, as opposed to issues of leadership in the home. The sort of piecing together what exactly that means takes a lot of work. And I guess maybe, we'll talk about that
today. Yeah, let's hold off on the question of roles and, whether or not you agree with what the Bible has to say about them for a minute, and talk about just the question of what is femininity itself, right? So not what can women do, but what does it mean to be a woman in the first place? And maybe you can't separate those things. Victoria, Alexis, I'd love to hear what you guys have to think about this as well.
Alexis, I'll let you go first.
Sure. So one of the things I think is interesting about this definition is it's a lot more flexible than you might think, given some of the comments that have been made over the years by some of the founding members of the Council for Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, specifically John Piper and others that would be considered what we called, I think, on our complementarian episode, broad complementarians as opposed to narrow complementarians. So that is those who would take the principles. So they would look at the biblical admonitions and language regarding gender roles in the home and the church and extrapolate from that out into roles in the world. So John Piper's famously had pieces where people have asked him questions and he's raised concerns about, a woman who wants to be a police officer or a woman who has a male secretary. What I think is really interesting about this definition is this definition does not necessarily lead to the conclusions that Piper has drawn because of that language in ways appropriate to a woman's differing relationships. So a woman who has a male secretary, the ways that she would encourage him, I guess, sort of the nurture strength, whatever you want to say that, that are appropriate to that relationship, that gives her a lot of flexibility. The woman police officer who is arresting a male suspect, the ways that are appropriate to that relationship gives her a lot of leeway to still be a perfectly competent police officer. So I think that there's a lot more flexibility in that definition than some of the proponents of that definition have in their own personal convictions. So I realize that some people, are not going to agree with the definition full out, and that's I realize there are reasons for that. But I do think the language of the definition itself is not as limited as people sometimes understandably conclude based on, like I said, other writings by the council or by its members.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I was actually shocked at the kind of social wiggle room present in this definition, especially given Grudem's 3 or 4 page list of church roles that women can and can't occupy in the Big Blue Book. It's okay to be a greeter, but not okay to be an usher, and not okay to be this kind of deacon, but is okay to be this kind of deacon. I feel like there's a lot more room here, and I was happy to see that. Though, that being said, I do definitely think there's some stereotypical or stereotypically colored gender here. Women affirm and receive and nurture and men are strong and lead. That's a little flat to me.
Yeah,
not only worthy men.
That's true. That is important.
It's interesting. I think for those reasons, Victoria, I was a little bit surprised at the statement, which seems narrower than at least some of the other places in which Grudem or Piper talk about it. Because, I mean, a lot of times when they talk about it, it's very narrowly construed to the realm of the home or the church. I mean, there's kind of what they explicitly say, and then there's kind of the vibe that you occasionally get about how that's connected to, a broader kind of complementarian. But, I mean, to me, I mean, this language of it's the language of receiving and nurturing, and then really connecting that to, like, I mean, the picture to me is really one of subordinate. The role is to encourage and enable men, and so, like, as a picture of the nature of femininity, it looks like, and it's painting them as, like, the job is to, that their job is to support and enable men. I mean, it's very much that picture that you get from Genesis about painting Eve as a helper, which is a really important part of their theology. But it's striking to me because, like, this is portrayed really widely as opposed to narrowly, specifically talking about the role in the home or in church.
Otherwise, another book that we talked about in the last episode on masculinity was a book called Wild at Heart by John Eldredge, which was sort of a evangelical cultural phenomenon in the mid-90s about how men are, you know, really wild at heart and need to go out and, you know, wrestle with bears and beat on each other with baseball bats or do whatever it is that it's been a while since I've read the book. Eldredge's wife also wrote a book called Captivating. It did not have the same widespread appeal, but it was basically a picture of a woman. So, Alexis, can you tell us a little bit about femininity in the book Captivating?
Yeah, so one of the things I think that's important to mention when we're talking about the Eldredges is, and it's also been a while since I've read these books, but I don't think that their aim was to write something normative in the sense that you read this book and then you become different than you already are. I think that the appeal of Wild at Heart, as they understood it, was that you would read the book and recognize yourself in the book, that this would be telling you things that you already knew or suspected or had never realized, but now understood were true about yourself. So I think for the men who read the book, that the goal was, you know, recognize yourself in this book when we're talking about what you really want. And then for women who read the book, that they would recognize that this is what men are really like and give them permission to do this and encourage them in this masculinity, this pursuit of masculinity. So Captivating, from what I can remember in my brief review of it, continues that theme where the idea is not what you ought to do as much as a woman. And again, I'm there may be parts of the book that had that, but in large part that it would be writing a book that then a woman who reads it would recognize herself and be like, yes, that is me. And part of why this is the case is that they distill down their ideas of femininity and masculinity for purposes of their book, not to behaviors or character or anything like that, but to desire. So in Wild at Heart, the three desires that are shared by men, according to the Eldredges, are the desire for a battle to fight, the desire for adventure, and the desire for a beauty to rescue. So those are three desires. So again, not necessarily you need to go and do this particular thing, but you have these desires as a man. So then in Captivating, they turn then to women and they say, here are the three desires or longings that women share, the desire to be romanced, the desire to play an irreplaceable role in a great adventure, and the desire to unveil beauty. So those are the three desires. So again, it's not exactly saying strive for this, do this, change yourself to be like this. It's more saying, isn't this true about you already? And another point that I think is interesting about the Eldredges' view of these issues is that in large part, when they're trying to find the true longings that people share, they're very focused on the longings that you had as a child. So the idea is your truest indication of what your real longings are as a man, as a woman, are in fact what your longings were as a boy and as a girl. So the idea is that as a boy in your fantasy play, didn't you always want to have an adventure? And as a girl in your fantasy play, didn't you always want to be beautiful, be romanced and be seen as beautiful and be part of this adventure? So, which I think is very interesting because I think there are legitimate questions about how much we want to look to childhood perceptions as a reliable indicator of various things, and how much those childhood desires are not necessarily inherent of themselves either, but can also be influenced by the outside world. But anyway, that's their view. Like Coyle said, captivating was never the culturally significant work that Wild at Heart was, but they did come out with it a few years after Wild at Heart. So again, it's not really a normative definition. It's not really, you know, women ought to be a particular way. It's more supposed to be women share these three desires, according to the Eldridges.
So I don't think Ed and I can answer this question. Are they right about the three desires that women share?
I will just say that I went on a date once with a guy in college that I met through my Baptist student union. During our first date conversation, he had read Wild at Heart, and I believe Captivating had been released fairly recently, and he was talking about how much he wanted a woman like that, and I did not go on a second date with him. So that's how much I agree with the Eldridge's definitions, I guess.
I guess there are elements that I think are certainly anecdotally true. I don't feel confident saying that women everywhere experience those desires because I can't speak for women everywhere. And I think certainly that the women I came in contact with, you know, would share those and those would resonate with them. I will say one thing that I appreciate about the Eldridges, well, a couple of things. One is that they were actually trying to push back against the sort of boring church wife picture. Like, so they were trying to add things like, you don't just want to be, mild and meek and make casseroles. Like, you want to be part of an adventure. And they talk about you going whitewater rafting together as a family and how exhilarating it was for them to all be facing this danger and overcoming this obstacle together. So I appreciate the idea of turning the gaze outward, and it's not just about the opposite gender and you're subsumed in this goal to orient yourself around them. There's this idea of a shared adventure, shared calling, whatever you have that echoes, I think, the mandate that you see in Genesis for man and woman to go forward and embark on this adventure of subduing and filling the earth. So I appreciated that. And I thought that there were some elements in it that were helpful. One of the points that they make early on is that women are sort of always told that they are both too much and not enough. And I thought that was a very apt way to describe some of the ways that women hear about themselves or perceive themselves in the ways that they're treated and the ways that they envision themselves in the world. So, I mean, I thought there were things there that fit with what I had observed in myself and other people. But again, I don't know whether or not that's true for everybody. And same way that I don't know that men, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there are men who would say, no, that's not me. I don't want a battle to fight. I don't want adventure. I don't want, you know, beauty to rescue. I just, generalizations are always hard because there's not really a way to prove them.
Right. And I guess I should say, I don't want to be too glib. I do think there's some good in those definitions. Alexis, you make a good point about the joint adventure. I also remember, though it's been several years since I've read both of these books, I do remember appreciating the fact that sexual desire within marriage is treated as normal and good and not taboo. I appreciated that from a Christian perspective, though I do take issue with the sort of really strong emphasis on truth in childhood perception of self And and I'd be lying if I didn't say I'm a little bit bothered at the women want to be part of an adventure. Well, yes, I do, but also I can have my own adventures just fine, or my husband can be a part of those, and both things are good.
The thing that's a little frustrating with accounts like that is they aren't usually sensitive at all to the extent to which those perceptions of femininity or masculinity are shaped by social and historical circumstance. And so it would be nice if there was at least like some sensitivity to that. I mean, it's, and you know, in saying that, that doesn't mean that everything is socially constructed all the way down, but it's just like, it's a little bit convenient that like, I mean, I don't know, the way that men and women thought of themselves in the 19th century American frontier, that's the, you know, that's the correct conception, even if that's not the conception that's held, say, before then or after then or in different parts of the world at different times. That's just a kind of a running frustration that I have with some of these accounts.
Well, and certainly the Eldridges, if I recall correctly, they rely very heavily on this idea of what are the stories that move you. If they move you, it must be because this truth is resonating with you. So if the story that you love is Braveheart, if you love watching Braveheart, it's because you want to be William Wallace. Or if you love watching, I don't even remember what the other movies are, but like if you enjoy the rom-com, or if you enjoy the adventure story, that is, and I think there is a way in which that is true, right? Stories that are telling true, like saying true things, true stories in that ultimate sense do resonate with us. So I think there's something true there, but I don't know that you can assume that any story that resonates with you is necessarily depicting this deeper truth.
Yeah.
And that's very much what they do. Like they point to this story and like, isn't this moving when I don't even know. I think it's Dances with Wolves or something. No, it's Last of the Mohicans, which I've never seen either of them. So that's why I'm getting them confused. But like how moving it is that he rescues her, or how moving it is that they do this adventure together. And if it's moving, you know, if it touches you, that's that root desire that you have that is what you, and of course, I have all kinds of problems with, you know, just go with whatever your deepest desire is.
Yeah.
Because we know from scripture that our desires are the last thing that we need to be following as our ultimate guide. So,
yeah.
Well, and there's also, I know this isn't what either of the books are doing, but there's a lack of self-awareness or a lack of humility in that view. Like if you watch Braveheart, yes, you know, maybe you want to be William Wallace, but more likely you're going to be random soldier number 15. And it kind of doesn't matter what side you're on, because you're probably going to die. Mm-hmm. And it's like when I teach students, you know, Plato, everyone reads that and thinks, oh yeah, I'm totally the philosopher king. And you're not. I mean, none of us are. Like you're a craftsman at best. And same thing there. I mean, it's yes, there is something appealing about going on an adventure or fighting a battle or what have you, but there also needs to be the realization that if I'm fighting a battle, I'm going to be down in the trenches with a bunch of other privates. But, and other thoughts on this, captivating, or Wild at Heart, I guess, since we brought that back in.
No, let's keep trucking.
Yeah. To Ed's point about the culturally constructed stuff, some of the most culturally constructed of all definitions of femininity or lack thereof come from 20th century writers. Victoria, can you talk us about a couple of those? Talk to us about a couple of those.
Sure.
I'm not going to attempt pronunciations on these. I'm sorry. That's out of my skill set.
That's okay. I will try not to butcher the French pronunciations myself. So I'm going to talk about two fairly central feminist theorists that whose theories influence what we come to know as the second wave. And the first is Simone de Beauvoir's landmark 1949 text, The Second Sex. So in the beginning of the first edition introduction, she says she's going to describe, quote, how woman is taught to assume her condition, how she experiences this, what universe she finds herself enclosed in, and what escape mechanisms are permitted her. So the central idea of her theory is that femininity is not innate, it's socially constructed, or to use Beauvoir's phrase, probably familiar to most of you, one is not born a woman, but becomes one. So that's her first idea, that that womanness, that not female, not to be female, but to be feminine, is a social construction. She differentiates between sex and gender, sex being biological and gender being social. And she goes on to note that in addition to being learned, femininity is deeply connected with the idea of otherness. It would never occur to a man to write a book on the singular situation of males in humanity, she says. But as a woman, if I want to define myself, I first have to say I am a woman. All other assertions will arise from this basic truth. So what she's saying here is that default humanity is masculine humanity. Female humanity is female first and humanity second.
I actually have a question. And this is another of those that I don't think Ed or I can answer. With that second point of you, women think of themselves as women first and then humanity second because of that other definition. Do you guys think that's right? Is that a fair reflection of the way women perceive themselves?
I certainly think it's a fair perception of the way my society perceives me and wants me to perceive myself. Is it a fair assessment of the way I perceive myself? I don't know.
I've certainly heard that used with racial arguments. So I have friends who will talk about thinking of themselves as, you know, not just men, but African-American men in a way that I certainly don't wake up in the morning and think of myself as a white man. And I had not heard that as stated quite that forthrightly. So anyway, I found it kind of intriguing. So I was kind of curious as to whether or not it was true.
I mean, I think you see that in a lot of small ways. For example, if you look in the style section of most newspapers, style meaning like about fashion and housewares and those sorts of things, that's also where you find parenting articles in most cases, because parenting is a woman's issue and the style section is sort of where the women's issues get locked up in the newspaper because they're not issues, they're women's issues. So I do think there are a million sort of tiny ways that our society says we are women first and people second. And that's just sort of one that's top of mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the point that you made about race, Coyle, was exactly the point that I saw. And there's just a way in which when you're a man, all of the assumptions that are associated with masculinity are widely shared and are unspoken. And the world is designed in such a way as to sort of accommodate those things, so you don't even notice those accommodations in just the way that, you know, at least in the United States, like a similar kind of social construction happens around race. So like, we can talk about black culture or we can talk about Asian culture, but like the idea that there's like white culture is like weird, or that like whiteness is a thing. It's like, we don't notice those things precisely because like the whole world is structured in ways or sort of are built around those norms.
Right. Although, maybe. Well, I don't know if it is less so with masculinity or not. I mean, I feel like more thought is put into what masculinity is than what whiteness is. But that might just be because I've been thinking about, you know, books like Wild at Heart lately.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, sorry to derail there, Victoria.
No,
do you want to keep going through the texts?
Sure. As I said, Beauvoir is writing in 1949, so mostly I think in between what most feminist historians would call the first and second waves, and the second theorist I'm going to discuss is Helene Cixous, who's writing in the 60s and 70s in France, and we read her short essay, Sorties, which is French for exits. And in this essay, she essentially argues for an exit from what she says is the gendered way we organize kind of all the big capital letters things we use to organize our lives, all the big things that the Christian humanist guys in their tagline say that human beings do well, theology, philosophy, literature, history, etc. She says that in these organizations, we divide everything that we think of into binaries. We are a people of binary oppositions, and that the kind of master binary above all of these binaries is masculine and feminine, and further down from that, not only are all binaries divided into masculine and feminine sides, but in these binaries, the masculine is always privileged over the feminine. She says, this is bad, it's narrow, it hurts all of us, it hurts men as well as women, it oversimplifies the way we live our lives, our lived experiences. We use these binaries to kind of box ourselves in. But these systems are so ingrained within us and our society that they're really hard to get out of. If I have a favorite feminist theorist, it's probably Cixous, though I don't think she's perfect. What I love about this essay is I do think it's a good starting place to understand how patriarchal thought is transmitted and how gender constructions, particularly rigid gender constructions, can hurt us. But it also leaves some space for the existence of innate and positive masculine and feminine traits, which I don't think Beauvoir does as much. I do wish that Cixous worked a little bit more in posing a solution to the problem here. The essay just kind of says, this is really hard, we might not get out of it, but it's not enough to flip the binary over. What we need to do is kind of explore the middle spaces, and then the essay ends. So I wish there were more of a solution. But I gather that Coyle did not like the Cixous and is going to push me on it.
I mean, I liked it in that it was interesting to read. So it's yeah, I went to say I didn't like it isn't the whole truth.
Sorry to
radically
put words
disagreed.
In your mouth.
No, it's okay. I radically disagreed with several of the conclusions. Not least of which not even assumption or implication, but the outright statement that basically everything is grounded on the domination of men over women. And again, this may just go back to the, I don't wake up in the morning and think about masculinity or being a man and what can I do to, you know, oppose, or oppress women today. So maybe there is an unreflectiveness there that leads to that gut reaction. But, yeah, my bigger hesitation than that really is the movement of the essay towards the idea that rationality itself is masculine and oppressive. Is that an overstatement? Am I reading too much into it?
I don't necessarily think you are, though I think she's just saying that rationality is often gendered masculine and sort of bodilyness is gendered feminine. I think she's doing much the same extension of gendering the Cartesian split that Susan Bordeaux does around the same time.
No, I'm not familiar with Susan Bordeaux.
So Bordeaux just says one of the sort of central extensions, one of the ways that we get the philosophy of patriarchy handed down to us is that the Cartesian split, the idea that the mind is sort of higher and more controlled than the body, Bourdieu says that this split becomes gendered, and the mind is masculine and the body is feminine. I think that Sixu there, that statement about rationality is saying much the same thing. And I don't think she thinks it's a good thing, this, this sort of mind-body, split mm-hmm. being gendered so rigidly. I think she's trying to push against the societal rigidity of that.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, and then of course all of the standard objections about the purpose of Western civilization is not really to oppress women, but I don't know that would be too useful a rabbit trail to fall down to.
Well, I mean, like part of the idea, it's not just that. Like, I mean, you made that joke about waking up in the morning and wanting to oppress women, and like, I mean,
oppress it.
Sorry, yeah, is that not what I just said?
Oh, I thought you said impress.
Do you wake up in the morning and not think about wanting to impress women?
Ed, I'm married. I don't have to care about that anymore.
I mean, if you just want to segue into Sixu throwing shade at Freud, I can do that too, because I feel like you're Freudian slipping us right in there.
Hey, there we go.
Well, yeah. So anyways, right, it's not just about like these intentional acts, though that happens. I mean, so that certainly happens too, right? But it's all the way in which – it's all the unintentional ways in which – social structure and social expectations get set up in ways that are oppressive of women, right? And so the way in which girls are discouraged from pursuing traditionally masculine fields, you know? And so
or the ways in which boys are discouraged sure. from doing anything feminine. Like I actually think boys probably get this worse than girls nowadays. Mm. I mean, I think it's actually about anti-feminism, but, you know, I feel like people would be much more willing, for example, for a girl to wear a Superman shirt mm-hmm. than they would for a boy to wear a Wonder Woman shirt because masculinity is aspirational in a way that femininity isn't.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Or like you know, you can describe somebody as a tomboy, and that could be a term of praise, precisely because masculinity is aspirational. But yeah, describe a boy as a Jane boy, and that's obviously going to be like the worst thing that you could.
I think it's significant that you can't even find the word, right? We don't have social language for that in a positive way. I mean, he throws like a girl, or he's a sissy, or a mama's boy, or whatever.
Yeah. But the general point there is that like all of these things, I mean, they're occasionally intentional, but they're all the more insidious precisely because they're not intentional. They're just sort of built into certain kinds of social norms and expectations that shape us. And then you don't even need to go around and order people not to do things. It's just they're kind of quietly nudged by these norms that shape us. So
yeah, it's invisible.
Are you skeptical about like that social construction of femininity?
I am in part because it's to some extent begging the question. It's making assumptions that I think maybe I guess I don't know about this author. Maybe she argues them elsewhere, and I'm just not familiar. I've never read anything. How do you say her last name, Victoria?
Sixu.
Sixu, yeah. So this is the first thing of hers I've ever read. But yeah, it seems to be sort of jumping in with the with certain assumptions about femininity, which obviously it's a short essay, so you wouldn't necessarily expect them to be fully worked out here.
And I will say, I mentioned this in my summary, but I should elaborate. Her other work actually leaves much more space for the presence of innate gender, innate femininity, or innate masculinity. Mm-hmm. Specifically, an essay that, correct me if I'm wrong, Alexis, but I think you were on the CFP episode where we read The Laugh of the Medusa. Was that you?
I mean, her name sounds familiar, and I can't imagine why it would sound familiar other than from a a feminist episode, just because it's not anything I would have come across in my academic career. So,
were you on the episode we did about Me Too and Church Too?
I was not. No.
Okay. Sorry to mistake you for someone else. Anyway, we did an episode where we read Cixous, The Laugh of the Medusa, where she argues for a specifically female kind of writing, a specifically feminine kind of writing that she calls lecture féminine. Sorry, people, for my terrible French pronunciation, but the literature of woman. She says woman must write woman and man man, because there's a kind of expression that can only come from the lived female experience, and that she talks about writing with mother's milk and things like that. So she really does, I think, leave much more space for that kind of bodily expression and that kind of innate femininity, certainly than Beauvoir does. Beauvoir doesn't want to talk about bodily experience at all.
Mm-hmm. And so for Cixous, those are rooted in biology.
Yes. I mean, she thinks that there are also ways that biology is oppressive, but the thing that I should have had us read Laugh of the Medusa instead, but the thing that she comes back to in The Laugh of the Medusa is men think that women are these sort of leaky, uncontrolled vessels, and they're right, and there is sort of power in the fact that men think women are uncontrolled, and women need to realize that there's power in that and embrace their kind of feminine leaky wildness. So I do think she, while she sees oppression in constructed gender, she also sees a kind of freedom in biology too, and that those things sort of work, push against and work with each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, anything else on either of these second wave feminist definitions?
Just to clarify and make sure I'm understanding this, because I've not read a lot on the topic, but from what you've said, Victoria, it sounds like that opening question that de Beauvoir had, are there even women, essentially, her answer would sort of be either no, or only because society has made them women, or yes, but there oughtn't be women. Are those like fair constructions of where she lands in response to that question?
They're not unfair. I don't want to answer that question 100%, because I haven't read the whole book. I mean, what I gave you guys to read is a 15-page introduction of a 700-page treatise on gender. So this does not answer all of those questions. The reason that I wanted us to read the introduction is, in fact, because one of the things she does in the introduction is refuse to out and out answer the question. She essentially says, right, like, too many people have asked women this question. It's a boring question. It's an annoying question. There are more important questions.
Okay. And so then Cixous, from what you're saying, from her responses would be, there are women, but the things that make them women are always ultimately rooted in their biology. Like they would be only to the extent that biology has made them women that they are women. Does that make sense?
I don't think Cixous would say only biology. Okay. I certainly think part of her answer would be agreeing with Beauvoir in that men are default humans and women are not men. And I think that she would sort of agree that binary is forced on them by society, and that there's some freedom from it in biology. But I don't know that she would say there's complete freedom found in biology. I think part of what she wants to do, is explode, that binary, through some social means too.
So obviously we have a lot of definitions here and a lot of choices. I don't know if there are more definitions of femininity than there are of masculinity, but they are certainly in some ways much farther apart. So there's a lot more space between the second wave feminist readings and the Council of Biblical Manhood and Womanhood than there was, say, between the Art of Manliness and the Council of Biblical Manhood and Womanhood in our previous episode. Why is femininity something that's so difficult to define? Why isn't there an Art of Womanliness episode out there dedicated to recapturing the lost art of womanliness in a society that's encouraging, you know, little girls to grow up and act like men? Why is this such a slippery issue for us? Is it the patriarchy? Is it, you know, historiographical problems? Something else that we're not including? What are our thoughts on this?
I do think that those definitions of womanliness exist. There certainly are conservative Christian books and blogs of the kind that you mentioned. But I also think that it's a canonicity problem, that I do agree with what Sixu says about default history being history from a male perspective. So I think that the reason that those texts are harder to find is that they've been historically devalued. Things like household manuals and cookbooks from the medieval and Renaissance period, women's diaries, these are starting to be unearthed in the past 80, 100 years, and really starting to be studied by scholars and validated as important historical texts just a few decades ago. So I think there's just been more time to process history from a default male perspective, and that's part of the reason that it isn't as solidified.
Mm. Yeah, and there's just a kind of an asymmetry. So, I mean, there are two genders and there are associated conceptions of masculinity and femininity. So it kind of looks like everything is just the same. But then obviously masculinity is just aspirational in a particular kind of a way. And more dominant in terms of like, this is normal. This is the way that things should be. And because those norms have been associated with being in positions of power, they're just going to be more dominant. But I'm a little bit confused, Coyle. So in what way is these definitions are contested, but you know, when we put out episodes on masculinity and on femininity, I mean, everybody knows what they're going to be about, right?
What do you mean? We will be talking about men in one episode and women in another episode.
Yeah, but what is masculinity? I mean, there's a really obvious answer to that question. It's about aggression. It's about strength. It's about stoicism. It's about rationality. It's about leadership and protection. Physical courage. It's about all of those things. When we talk about femininity, it's about being emotional. It's about being irrational. It's about being domestic and supportive and weak and nurturing, about being concerned with one's beauty. It's like we all know what those things are. And then those ideas are contested precisely because, you know, there's a sense that those particular conceptions of both masculinity and femininity don't attach to real human ontology, or are distortions of real human ontology. But I don't know that.
Or they do, right? I mean, that's the problem is that you have people arguing that they do attach.
Oh, sure.
And then you've got the we're back to the problem of definition, right? We're back to I'm going to butcher the name, de Beauvoir. Am I saying that right?
Close enough.
Sorry. I always get that mixed up with The Simpsons. I think Marge Bouvier, and yeah. Yeah. So we end up with that on one side saying, you know, all of those definitions are wrong. And maybe there's no definition at all. And the Council of Biblical Manhood and Womanhood saying, yeah, that's the right definition.
Well, I think part of what you might be talking about is sort of what Victoria mentioned earlier, And that is, there's been a lot of effort put into saying there's more than one way to be a woman. And we've got some even in the mainstream, some ways to do that. But I think masculinity is not there yet. It's like, I think that there is more cultural agreement, or at least that the disagreement is still hasn't gained that footing, for good or for ill. I think you, like Victoria was saying, like, you can be the tomboy and say, I want to grow up and I want to, you know, climb trees, or I want to be an engineer. Or I'm going to go to the moon or whatever. And there is a place for that in society, and you can be welcomed and celebrated in a way that there is not yet that. Oh, I don't know what would be a good example of a stereotypically feminine career. I guess even still, you have the idea of a male nurse, right? Where there can still be that idea of, oh, okay, and it's not, you know, this celebrated, wonderful, you know, embrace your dream, whatever it is, reaching the stars. Because as you're saying, Ed, right, the idea is you're moving in an upward aspirational direction if you switch from the gendered female, you know, stereotypical path and move. You're getting promoted. But there is this idea that you, if you're a man on the, then you're already up there, and any movement toward the feminine is going to be a sort of a societal demotion. So I think that's a huge part of it. So yes, so society wide, you're going to have a lot more of the art of manliness, and it's going to all be about, you know, how sharp is your axe and what's your shaving kit of the month that you participate in, and not, it's not going to be someone who's writing all about how important it is to, you know, learn how to write poetry, and not necessarily poetry that's like when you're a woman or epic, you know, write about your great deeds poetry, but like feel your feelings poetry.
Right. If you spend an hour weeping at the sunset, you're not going to make it onto the Art of Manliness website.
Right. I mean, so that's just, I think that's just a reflection of where we are culturally.
Or like, I was even thinking about the recent Queer Eye reboot. Right, is still, I mean, it's not called Queer Eye for the straight guy anymore, it's just called Queer Eye, but what they're doing is still going into homes that are primarily about taking this sort of schlubby vision of masculinity and making it a more elevated masculinity, it's not about being feminine, it's about sort of being more cultured in a way that is gentlemanly. I think the same lack of movement is present.
Yeah. So that just gets at the asymmetry. It's like, it's telling that there's not Queer Eye for the straight girl.
I think the Fab Five occasionally make over women now. I have not watched any of the reboot though, so don't quote me on that.
Ah, okay. I haven't as well.
It's okay. I have not watched any of the original, so
I think I've only seen a clip of the original. But yeah, but that, you know, but it's, and kind of the joke is that you have these gay men helping these straight men into a kind of a higher, more elevated manliness, and that's kind of the joke of the show, right? But pointedly, I mean, I don't think they're ever sort of like, well, this is how you write poetry, or.
No, the culture, like, one of them is the culture guy, and usually it's about, like, understanding art or drama, or, like, here's how you take your woman to an art museum and don't look like a moron.
And that, I does not sound like the kind of show I would have watched in college, but I was also in the minority, too. I know that they had parties for that in the house I lived in. Where on earth were we at, and how did we get onto that particular show?
No, it was just the discussion of why there's such a variety of definitions of femininity and a lack of variety in the definitions or the stereotypes of masculinity, that that there isn't that same variety of voices that you see, at least on the broader level. Obviously, there are those voices out there, but they don't have the same mainstream position.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Any other sort of historical problems, cultural moment problems?
No.
Otherwise, we should move on to the theological stuff.
Yeah. So can we talk about the theological stuff? I mean, because obviously for the Christian, you know, unlike secular accounts, I mean, Christians will obviously sort of talk about the role of biology and we'll lean on that. I mean, we'll lean on that a lot, actually, in part to kind of help give a foundation or flesh out theological conceptions. But it's the theological conceptions of masculinity and femininity that where the all the action really is.
Yeah. So we and again, I do want to point people to the Christian Feminist Podcast episodes on complementarian and egalitarianism, because that's where this question is going to come up most, right, when we're thinking about this as Christians. We had a comment from I forget who it was on the Facebook post on the masculinity episode from a listener, and I apologize, listener, I forget who it was who made the comment who argued that you can't use biology to determine sort of big, wide-ranging definitions, right? I think specifically said you can't use biology to determine ontology. So we can't look at someone's biological makeup and say, all right, this is the normative standard for everyone. And I think he's right. As a Christian, I'm comfortable saying, we have a higher standard that we use. We have the standard of God's word. And there are times when biology is out of line with that. We live in a fallen world, but we do still have this higher standard.
That was Jeffrey Carter, faithful listener, Jeffrey Carter. Yeah, and he referenced it was a radio lab. They had been running a kind of a trilogy on gender. I actually went back. It's probably bad for a podcast to be telling listeners to listen to other podcasts. But I think it's a three-part series on Radiolab on gender is really, really interesting. I actually meant to comment on Jeffrey's post, but yeah, it's super, super interesting. It's basically all about it's really easy to sort of to go to biology and be like, well, look, that's a super hard line, obviously, because obviously men are different from women. There are all the obvious anatomical differences. And look, we can even now point to the genetic basis of that. It's X, it's XY and it's XX.
Right.
But the at least the most recent of those Radiolab episodes, it's all about like deeper genetic research into the way in which those gendered physical traits manifest themselves, and especially the discovery of these two really trigger genes, as well as a larger story about the way in which there's a tremendous amount of gender fluidity actually in different species. So like there are scores of different kinds of fish, for example, that flip-flop between being male and female. It's a complete wholesale biological flip-flop. And then equally that trait, sort of something like that trait, appears to be sustained in human beings. There is a part of you, Coil, that wants to be a woman, but then there's another part of you, a gene that constantly shuts that down, is the idea. But the point of all of that is that like the more we understand about like the genetic bases of gender, I mean, it's not to say that there isn't such a thing as a man and such a thing as a woman, but it's to say that those distinctions, as we drill down, they're not super, super hard and fast. I commend that episode, even though I probably shouldn't, as somebody who's self-interested in our own podcast. But anyways.
Once you have listened to all of the City of Man podcasts, go back and listen to Radiolab.
Yeah, you can go pick up a few Radiolab episodes. But so it's really convenient in some ways to go to biology, but then the biological story actually gets complicated. But then for Christians, the theological story is going to have a kind of a primacy, obviously, even if it's not necessarily less contentious.
Yeah, and it is and it isn't, right? So the sort of overarching biblical truths that, again, I think everyone can agree on, there is gender, right? There are men and there are women, and they are in some ways different, and they are in some ways the same. So I think the Bible is pretty clearly egalitarian in some sense, in that salvation is open to everyone, without regard to the other gender. Right. So if you are a man, you can be saved. And if you are a woman, you can be saved. And your salvation is not contingent on the actions of, you know, whatever all the men in your society are doing or whatever all the women in your society are doing. So there is that equality in scripture that can't be denied. But
Galatians
the Bible
3:28,
also, right. The Bible also lays out differences between men and women. And as you guys had talked about earlier in the episode, right, differences in the home and differences in church. And Christians have at various times and in various ways tried to take those differences and apply them to other parts of society. I'm always a little suspicious of those. Scripture doesn't do that. So I'm a bit hesitant too, but doesn't stop people from doing it, I suppose. What do you guys think? Let's throw this open to everyone, so I'm not just the only person monologuing here.
I think one of the things, and we didn't actually get to this point in our episode on complementarianism, but among certain conservative Christian circles, this idea of mere complementarianism or narrow complementarianism is very much in vogue, because it allows us to sort of navigate the wider world and say, yes, go be an astronaut, go be a CEO. You know, all that we care about is fealty to these specific restrictions in the home and in the church. And what I think is interesting there is that you end up with this conservative sector of Christianity that is essentially agreeing with the point that de Beauvoir was making, like is essentially saying there is not such a thing as a woman, or there's only such a thing as a woman at home and at the church, mm-hmm. and everywhere else there is not or ought not to be such a thing as a woman, which I think is not always where they intend to be, but I think it's what they end up, the conclusion or the idea that they end up connecting with. And I think that's interesting because then once you've said there is no such thing as a woman in these other spheres, you certainly have the potential to increase the degree to which the existence of women in those spheres appears to be arbitrary. So it appears like, mm-hmm. Well, wait, if there's not of such a thing as a woman in the wider world, she's just a human person who happens to have a particular body and has been treated by society, perhaps a particular way. But in and of herself, she is not a woman and that there is no such thing as a woman. Why in these two places? Why? Like,
yeah,
And so now, obviously, I think, you know, as a believer in a God who created humankind, there is a degree to which I'm happy to say, yeah, God is allowed to be arbitrary or to seem arbitrary to us. That can sometimes happen. But I think that is a way in which the broad complementarians, like that's not an issue for them. They're not, like they're saying there are women are women everywhere. And the same, whatever the principle is that results in women existing in the church and in the home, well, they continue to be women when they go out in the world. And so mm-hmm. there are ways that affects them in the world. Mm-hmm. So while there are certainly problems with the broad complementarian view and ways that presents a big stumbling block to the world's understanding of the church's teaching on gender, I want to make sure we're charitable and say, well, look, they have weaknesses. They have things that are unpalatable to the world and possibly with very good reason, but they are responding to this idea of why are there only women at church and at the home? Like if we get to be whatever we want everywhere else. So I think that's really interesting. And I think it's one of the questions that I have about some of the mere complementarian views. I think from an economic perspective, I understand it and I agree. I don't want to go beyond what scripture teaches. But when I look at Genesis 1, it does seem like there's such a thing as a woman. And I think you guys made this point in the masculinity episode that essentially, yes, there is such a thing as masculinity, but I don't know what it is. And I would say that's the same thing that we can sort of, as much as we can maybe argue from scripture, is I think that the creation account seems to indicate we're not just talking about male and female. There's something else that's going on. This is not just male and female he created, and we have this more complicated creation narrative. So it seems like there is such a thing as a woman, but if we're thinking of that as a field to fill in, there's not a whole lot of things that I would be willing to say, this is what goes in that field. This is what that means. Mm-hmm. Because the admonitions to me as a woman are, you know, like you guys talked about, the same kind of character-based admonitions. Like I should also be courageous. I should also be willing to to protect those that I love. And maybe it looks a little different, but anyway, all of which to say, I think I'm not willing to go the full length of say de Beauvoir or of even the, like I said, the mirror or narrow complementarian and say there is no such thing as a woman except in an economic sense in these two settings. But I'm also not comfortable going beyond what scripture has said and saying there are all of these rules for women outside of those two settings. So like you guys said with masculinity, I think from my understanding of the scripture as a whole, it does mean something different to be created as a woman and not just because of how the world treats me. I think there is something that is part of the way God chooses to reflect his image, but I don't know what it is. So I guess that's kind of a cheater answer, but anyway, those are my thoughts on the theological issue.
If I can chime in for just a second, I agree with the problems that, Alexis, you've pointed out in the mere complementarian view. I do think there's some sticky points there, but I would almost prefer those problems to the problems of the opposite end that to me don't that equate being a woman with really, really narrow conceptions of femininity and sort of just want to give me a Bible journal with a daisy on it and really kind of don't fully let me be the imago Dei the way man would be allowed to be. Like I think that there are sort of those are two ends of the same spectrum, and I would prefer one wrong over the other wrong, if that makes sense, though that's terrible to choose between two negatives.
And I wouldn't disagree. I think that sometimes we can think that mere complementarianism is like the cheat, right? Where you can have a conservative viewpoint, but in this way that is more socially palatable or culturally palatable. And I think it's worth pointing out that like it has problems with it. And so, like I said, I'm not comfortable going beyond, you know, and saying women cannot do these things in the secular or in the wider world. And I've never been someone who fit the stereotype of what feminine was supposed to be either. So I certainly, I certainly wouldn't embrace, don't send me a Bible with a daisy on it either. And I really don't need to color. I actually would rather read words than color them.
I know you're on my show all the time. I know what a loudmouth you are.
So my raising those caveats about the mere complementarian viewpoint is not to say therefore flee to the other end of the spectrum and it's, you know, ankle length denim jumpers for everybody and forget STEM education because what you really need to learn is you know how to cook and clean.
Oh no, absolutely not. And I wasn't saying that you were saying that. I am pro the middle of that spectrum. I was just saying also I think one wrong is better than the other wrong.
That's fair.
So I mean those are really good points. And so like on the one hand, we have this very traditional theological conception of masculinity and femininity that's problematic for a whole variety of different reasons. I mean, maybe in some ways we could wade into some of those issues, but, and then on the other hand, you have this more palatable version, but that's like unstable or unmotivated. If we could build out, a conception as far as we can, right? So we know that what it is, part of what it is to be human is to be made as male and female. Like there's something about the fact that together we constitute the imago Dei and that the two genders are like a thing, right? And that we know that in some deep way, the relationship between men and women is supposed to mirror our relationship, the relationship between Christ and the church and all of us. So we know that, and so we know that there's something about the gender differences is supposed to capture a deep theological truth, and there's something about that difference and desire and relatability and relational aspects of that that's really important in capturing the deeper truth that we were made to relate to each other and then to relate to the God who created us. So we know all of that stuff. Are we all okay with this so far?
So far.
Yes, it sounds good to me.
And then, all right, so what does it mean? Traditionalists would make a lot of hay about the domestic teachings that we find in the Pauline epistles. They'll make a lot of hay about the description of Eve as a helper. And that idea is a really important idea that gets squeezed out to generate a lot of the traditional conceptions of femininity that they attach. One weird thing to me about those traditionalist conceptions is that, I mean, they're very balanced in some ways and limited, but then they're always like, you can tell that there's a broader, more traditional conception of gender that's attached to them. But then there's always this gap between sort of like this very careful theological picture and then these vague allusions to more traditional gender roles that aren't necessarily always attached, except for in those discussions of woman as helper, I guess.
One of the interesting pieces that I've run across, we've covered this author on the feminist podcast. Jen Wilkin is a fairly well-known Bible teacher in evangelical circles, and she's at Matt Chandler's church down in Texas, the Village. So she's coming at whatever, you know, issue, she's coming at it from a conservative view, theologically. But has also been very vocal about pushing back about sort of what healthy complementarianism looks like, as opposed to just sort of lazy complementarianism. And one of the things that she has done really well, is in specifically expositing, the creation account, is point out that the whole creation of Eve is predicated on and oriented around her sameness to Adam. Mm-hmm. The whole point, right, is he's, you know, all these animals are created before him, and she does a wonderful, beautiful way of expressing this, you know, not like me, not like me, not like me, not mm-hmm. like me. And then God creates Eve, and in her he says, like me, she is from me, she is like me, all of these language, these terms, mm-hmm. and then gives her the name that even is like his name, which is I think a very helpful starting point. And that's one of the reasons she dwells on it at some length whenever she talks about those passages, is because there is this tendency in the church, partly because we're pushing back against a culture that is blurring lines, but to immediately jump to, here's how men are different from women. And so she's encouraging people to start with, like, when we first meet men and women in the Bible, the first thing we're told about them is their sameness. And obviously that's in particular context, like you're saying, there is such a thing as a man, there is such a thing as a woman, whatever that means, there is a way in which God has chosen to reflect his image using this particular combination. But the first introduction to them is, like, they are the same. They are paired in a way that nothing else is paired mm-hmm. with either of them. They are more like one another than they are like anything else in creation. So I think that's a really helpful foundation to lay. As someone who comes at the things from a more conservative viewpoint, I am very familiar with those, like, immediate women are women and men are men and never the twain shall meet, and that tendency to get away from. Well, no, the first thing we're told is that these two uniquely image God, and they are more like one another than they are different.
Any other thoughts? I mean, there's a lot there. Other thoughts, Victoria? What do you have to throw into this?
Since you mentioned the word helper, I'm probably going to pronounce this incorrectly, but the Hebrew, is it Ezer?
Is that? I was reading some of this stuff earlier in a CBMW article. I think that's right.
So there's some discussion, some disagreement about the uses of this word Ezer, because God is that word, is a helper to man, and that's the same word that is used to describe woman's relationship to man, though In some versions, it's given a different modifier. So I think that's some of the root of the discussion about helper versus helpmeet and where those translations come from. But I do agree with what Alexis says in terms of sameness, and we on the CFP we did some discussion of various versions and translations of Genesis where you know in the differences between the J text and the P text in terms mm-hmm. of Adam and Eve being created at the same time versus Adam first and Eve second, and the various ways of interpreting that in terms of the relationship between husband and wife. So I don't want to rehash that either, but I do think what Alexis points out is the most important thing to point out, that that Eve and Adam are made for each other literally in that they are of the same kind. And that their imago Dei is equal.
Mm-hmm. And that in that relationship, there is this deep truth about how we relate to the Creator God.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, and I think, like, the Bible is really, really clear on all that stuff. So, yeah, and so there's, like, these tremendous debates about Azer and, like, yes, it can mean helper in a sense that doesn't apply anything about authority, but then traditionalists argue that, but in this context it does, and... But, like, there are all those things that Scripture is really, really clear about, really deep, central, important theological things. And then, I mean, I would say it's pretty silent on filling in all the other stuff. And so sometimes we want Scripture to be clearer about certain kinds of things than it is, but then, you know, it just isn't. And then we really need to tread carefully about what we assert about those things.
In essentials, right. Unity, and in non-essentials, liberty, man. Like we always say.
That's right.
There you go. If Scripture came right out and said, women should or should not be serving in frontline combat, it would solve at least one of our modern political issues.
Well, Grudem thinks it does, but...
We should probably wrap things up. Victoria and Alexis, thanks so much for coming on the show. We should not have talked about this without you. So thanks for coming and for contributing so much. And thank you, listeners, for joining us as well. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in the family and get more information about our own show and our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or shoot us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Ed Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.